Welcome to the Subversive Scribe Podcast, where we investigate the Hebrew Bible, Genesis through Chronicles, its instructions, teachings, and application. Learn how to interpret it correctly in context. Compare what it says in one part with another part, including and especially the New Testament. Let the text speak for itself in all its glory and in all its gore. Let the law, prophets, and writings be shield and spear. All it takes is the courage to hear it, seek it, and then decide on how you shall then live. The choice is always yours. I'm your show host, Jesse Heschel, and I invite you, even dare you, to join me on this journey on the Subversive Scribe Podcast. The biblical texts were always dangerous and subversive when allowed to speak on their own terms. Join the Scriven Insurgents, and let's get started with today's episode. All right, welcome to episode 3. Welcome to Paradise. Sounds intriguing, and hopefully it will be. This is your Subversive Scribe, Hesh, and let's get started on this episode. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to the Jewish method of interpreting scripture that has been developed over a long period of time. If you did not know, the Hebrew language itself has vowels, but it's consonantal. It has consonants, and then the vowel markers are added underneath or above, and that's what indicates how to pronounce a word, that and the context of a sentence. It's very grammatical, very contextual, very earthy kind of language, and it's actually very easy to learn. Think of it as an acronym. So if you took the word paradise, P-A-R-A-D-I-S-E, in English, if we took some consonants out and deleted the vowels, we would have P-R-D-S. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And each of those letters, P, R, D, and S, corresponds to a different layer in interpreting the text of, in this case, the Hebrew Bible. I want to note also that there are Christian versions of this and Islamic versions of this, and in many ways they are the same layers of interpreting and the same system of interpreting, though they might call it something a little bit different, or they might have a little bit different of an emphasis. You'll see as I get into the episode here. Now, Pardes, or Paradise, we'll just call it Paradise just to make it easy. P-R-D-S stands for Peshat, Remez, Darosh, and Sod. And those are all layers when we interpret. Layers, we can think about it as a hermeneutical layer on a cake. And you're going through the text and you're interpreting the text in that view. A Remez view, or a Darosh view, or a Sod view, kind of like that. And I'll talk about what those all mean. They all stand for something that is important. The rabbis did well at guarding this method and keeping this method, and you can see it in the Talmuds. There's the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. But you can see it in those interpretive systems and those interpretive texts, and they kept this alive and well to this day, and we are we should have gratitude for them doing so. There are other versions or denominations per se, sectarian portions of Judaism, like the Karaites, who work on exegesis on the Tanakh, and they focus largely on the Peshatist view, or the P in our story here, the P in the word paradise. And speaking of which, Peshat, that's P, that stands for straight, as in the plain sense, straightforward, base meaning of the text. This is what it means and is the primary reading. I can't emphasize that enough. Okay, the straightforward, plain sense reading of the text is what the text means. That is its primary hermeneutical interpretation. That is what it means. That is the primary reading. There are secondary and tertiary readings, third level readings, and we'll talk about Sod, which is the fourth layer. It's a mystical reading, and they're not in order. It's not, first you do this, and then you do this, then you do this, then you do this. There are approaches, just like we might look at a movie, and we might say, I'm going to look for examples of leadership in the movie Top Gun. And you go through the movie and you find these examples of leadership when the commander comes in and slaps Maverick on the shoulder and says, "Maverick, Goose is dead." And then walks out. That's not only one of the worst forms of leadership and comfort in a situation we also knew, and Maverick also knew in that movie because he was there. However, that's just one example of where we were intentionally looking for leadership traits in that movie. That's a subjective position that we're taking. But, that's just something that we're looking to. You might find it in a sermon. Maybe if I was a little more nuanced here and maybe appropriate, But, you know, a sermon could be a message about a specific topic or a specific feature or some kind of typology that you might be looking at. Now, you might use text to do that, some chapter of scripture to do that. So, for example, mountains and geography are a very interesting perspective in the Bible, the Hebrew Bible especially. You know, important things happen on mountains. And in the Christian New Testament, important things also happen on mountains. So in the Gospels, I think it's Luke and Matthew, there's the Mount of Transfiguration. And there's the Mount of Commissioning in the Gospel of Matthew, at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, where Jesus is in one location. And then, of course, when he ascends from a mountain in the north. Then in another Gospel, he ascends from a village near Jerusalem. It's about 90 miles apart. It's a problem in the text if you're looking at it. However, for our purposes here, important things happen on mountains. Moses is on the mountain. Elijah goes to the mountain to find God. It's the high places. They had offered sacrifices on the mountain. They had gone to those places to encounter the divine. And it was often thought that the gods lived in mountaintop experiences or mountaintop places that were hard to get to and were remote. And that idea of the mountain being a place of the divine wild, we find not just in the biblical text, but you find it in other mythologies throughout the world. You find it in Midgard or Asgard in the Norse tradition, where Asgard is this place where that is above the earth. It's high and above. You, of course, find it in the Greek pantheon with Mount Olympus. They live on the mountain of the gods, that kind of thing. So the idea of mountains being sacred spaces is something that shows up in lots of places. Now, if we were to look through and find examples of that, and I would call that biblical narrative geography, and I have a whole teaching on that, that is a subjective perspective. That is not what the text means. That's not the primary reading of the text. That's us reading something into the text itself. That might be more a drosh. That's more of a seeking, a comparative approach that we might use, where we can compare the mountain of Moses, where at Sinai, where Moses climbs the mountain to hear God, and we could compare that with the situation with Elijah, where Elijah goes out there to find God, and God speaks to him in a whisper. We could compare that also with the Mount of Transfiguration. If you're a Christian, you could look at that, and you can make a comparison between those and glean some kind of understanding. But the point of doing so isn't the primary reading. That's not what the text was written for. It's not its purpose. It just lends itself to another layer of interpretation. So Peshat is the way, is straight, and is the plain sense, straightforward, base meaning of the text. Now, some Jewish exegesis handles the straight meaning as handed down traditionally or traditionally interpreted. This is why Rashi's commentaries are often consulted in that category. The Karaites, a modern-day group of Judaism that, I don't want to say rejects the oral law outright, but doesn't accept its divine or authoritative basis on its face value. The Karaites, for example, are the biblicists of the Judaic tradition and are very focused on what the text says. Now, this can result in differences of opinion between what the rabbinic tradition says or what the rabbinic tradition has said and what the Karaite tradition notes. And you can find smaller examples about mezuzah and about putting on tefillin and things like that. They differ in what those passages mean, and because the Karaites are reading it at one level, at the straight level, on the plain sense, straightforward, base meaning of the text. And they're not reading it literally. Reading it literally is differently than reading it contextually. So anybody that tells you, well, you're reading a passage literally, or that, you know, this group believes in the literal interpretation, nobody totally believes in a literal interpretation because, again, different texts are different types of text. So if you're reading, say, the book of Daniel, no one believes that there's really a creature that has a feet made of iron and made of clay, and that comes out of the sea or something, and is there, you know, they don't believe that there are literal four beasts that will rule the world. And Christians don't believe that a literal dragon is going to show up and rule the world. Those are symbols or allegories, if you really wanted to read it that way, at another level. And it's not literal, but it's contextual. You read certain texts that are appropriate. You read Shakespeare as poetry. You read Eliot as poetry, Yeats as poetry, because you know that that's poetry, and that's how you're supposed to read it, right? So we don't apply principles of prose or principles of comedy, per se, to texts that are meant to be poetic. And we don't do vice versa. We don't do the opposite of that. You turn on a Netflix special of Dave Chappelle, and you know that it's comedy. That it's not meant to be a drama. It's not meant to be an action film. You know that it's an hour, hour and a half of stand-up. And we all do that, and we know that that is the category that we're getting into. Okay, so we interpret things in categories. We do this all the time, and we can do this with the biblical text itself too. So our next layer, R, or remez, that's allusion. So what is the text implying or alluding to? So this is when we start getting to these secondary layers and these third level layers, tertiary layers, and then fourth level layers. And what is the text implying or alluding to? And can we build something off of it? Now remember, in one of the earlier podcasts, I had said, you know, we are so remote and removed from the ancient Near Eastern world that there's a lot of stuff that isn't a one-for-one translation or doesn't have a context, might be a better way of putting it, that may not have the same context that it did then as it does now. So if you saw a passage or read a commandment about your neighbor's donkey falling into a ditch and helping them on the Sabbath, most people probably haven't even seen a donkey outside of Shrek, the movies, the Pixar movies. It's a just different world. So remez, we might say that is allusion, A-L-L-U-S-I-O-N, not illusion. What is the text implying or alluding to? So an example of implied remez, we could take Proverbs 20, verse 10. Different weights and different measures, both of them are alike an abomination to the Lord. The Peshat layer or approach to that verse, remember, that is the plain sense reading of the verse, would be concerned with a merchant using the same scale to weigh goods for all of his customers. The remez layer or remez interpretation implies that this goes beyond this and is actually discussing aspects of fairness and honesty in anyone's life. So that's really something closer to an application in our lives from a passage. So if different weights and different measures the Lord hates, well, then he probably hates it when I treat people differently. That would be a remez extension with more of an ethical twist, more of a praxis oriented, how we actually practice our faith and how we believe and how we act in the world. That is an example of an implication of that passage. But it could also apply at the Peshat level, at the straightforward level, right? So if you're a merchant, yeah, don't have different weights. Don't have different measures. Don't cheat people. Those different weights and different measures are to cheat people. Don't commit fraud. Don't do those things if you're a merchant. Don't be a thief. Now we know that Proverbs is a type of text. It's a wisdom text. It's there to teach you wisdom. So yes, it works at the Peshat level. Okay. So if you're a shop owner or a business owner of some stripe, and you know, you want to not commit fraud. You want to have measures and weights that are the same, different prices, doesn't work for different people. In fact, in some states, they actually ban that kind of behavior for merchants or for healthcare providers or that kind of thing, that there are laws in place that don't allow you to have a dual fee schedule. So the remez layer implies that this goes beyond into other ethical areas, aspects of fairness and honesty. And that's an important layer that has value. Now, the rosh, or D, and remember paradise, P-R-D-S, paradise, we're going to add the vowels. The rosh, that means seek. That is usually comparative or compares a passage with another passage or thought to produce an interpretive result. This can include episodic or parable type of interpretations that result in understanding of a specific point. In Jewish hermeneutics or nexegesis, this is usually associated with midrash. And it's something that you might find in a sermon, right? Something where, as I mentioned earlier, we're taking out portions and we're comparing that and we're maybe contrasting and coming up with an understanding. And in Jewish exegesis, they do this fantastically well. They are very good at this kind of thing. The Jewish tradition has spent a long time discussing the Rosh and discussing Midrash and what it means and how they live in the world today. And that makes some sense because the Jewish tradition is really focused a lot more on how do you act in the world. It's not the Greek position, which wants to know, you know, what are you? Which is an essentialist position. And that's the worldview that really the American culture is at right now. Those discussions about gender identity are essentialist questions. What am I in my essence? And the Jewish tradition might ask the question, what do you do? All right? So it might take a more practical and pragmatic approach where you are your deeds. So forget about asking questions about what is it in essence? What does it do? And I'll give you an example of the way the difference in thinking between the biblical worldview and the way that the Hebrew Bible works and thinks versus, say, a more Greco-Roman type of view. You can take the passage on, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Typically, when you hear this discussed, at least in the Christian church, they're talking about some kind of mystical union. And that mystical union is some kind of mystic bond between husband and wife. And that's why adultery is so horrific, is because it violates a spiritual bond. And this is why God hates divorce, because it's the breaking of a spiritual bond, which very well may be true. And if you've experienced adultery, it's traumatic, and you're never quite the same, and you live with scars for the rest of your life there. And there's a passage in Ephesians that speaks of that passage, and it uses it in an allegorical sense or some kind of spiritual sense. The Jewish tradition might look at it like a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two become one flesh. And that one flesh is a child, because a child is literally the combination of your DNA and your partner's DNA, and you produce something that is one flesh. And the practical application of that is a child. They don't ask the same type of question, and they think about the world differently. And that is the worldview of the Bible, and for Christians, that is the worldview that Jesus held. That's how he thought about it. Let's look at our last category here. That's the S, or sod. This sod is this fourth layer, is the esoteric or mystical meaning of a passage. This is usually associated with mysticism and the visionary experience. In fact, whole sects of religious practice have been focused on this level of interpretation. And the interpretation of a passage is for the purpose of understanding the world beyond, or heaven, or the spiritual world. This we might call a charismatic type of experience, or kind of charismatic type of Judaism, maybe. But the point is that it's expressed in these meditative trances and visionary experiences and these mystical experiences. You can look within the Jewish tradition, the history of it, to the throne mystics or the chariot Merkava mysticism in the Jewish tradition, which would focus on passages that speak of Hashem's throne or chariot. Hashem is typically the word used for God, and I use it judiciously, I guess. They speak of God's throne or chariot. So you could think of Isaiah 6. You could think of Ezekiel. You could think of the passage of Elijah, who is a chariot, comes down from heaven to take Elijah. He doesn't die. He passes his mantle on to Elisha, his disciple and student. And they focus on those passages for the purpose that they might experience those things mystically and understand them and have a personal visionary experience. We might call that unverified personal gnosis. Maybe one might call that an alternative state of, or altered state of consciousness. It is across the board. That experience, the mystical experience, is found within Judaism. It's a variant version. It's a minor version. And it's something that was taken very seriously, still is taken very seriously, and they want you to be grounded. They had a tradition, a story about a couple of rabbis that had practiced some of those things and how that harmed them. But they want you to be grounded, want you to be married, want you to be a person who studies Torah, want you to be over 40. And there's reasons for that, that they want to safeguard people. But you have mysticism in every different religion, so that Christianity, of course, has charismatics and Pentecostals, and those are very prominent, especially in the United States. And their influence into the world is large. Africa, Latin America, a lot of those places have experienced charismatic revival or renewal. And Pentecostalism started around 1904 at Azusa Street in Los Angeles. And that was kind of the birthplace of the Pentecostal movement in America, which gave birth to later to the charismatic movement, which is still with us today. We could also look to Islam. Islam has a mystical component to it, and Sufism. And they work towards having mystical union with God. And you could even look at Buddhist traditions, Hindu traditions. All religious traditions have mystical experiences. That's not unique. That is actually rather common to the religious experience altogether. That's why Judaism's claim is that it wasn't just a mystical experience that one person had, like Moses or Abraham. It was that God spoke to them from the mountain, that the whole nation heard their voice. It wasn't just a singular mystical, unverified personal gnosis experience. And of course, in the Jewish tradition, you have study of the Kabbalah, and you have Sufism and Islam. And again, in Christianity, you have Pentecostals or Charismatics. And they have a sodic approach to the scripture in these mystical variants. Now, I'm going to put that in quotes to say sotic, but it means that their understanding of the text, they read the text through the experience of mysticism. So for Pentecostals and Charismatics, that also includes a mystical understanding of the Tanakh, right? So of the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings, the Hebrew Bible. And that's why when you talk to them, most of those missionaries that go after Jews to convert them to Christianity, the reason they do that is because they see Jesus dripping off of the page, you know, every page in the Hebrew Bible, because they're reading the text through a mystical lens. They have a personal experience, and that personal experience is guiding their reading of the text. We might call that eisegesis. We can call it a couple different things, but that's really what's driving their experience. And sode is somewhere between allegory and mysticism. But again, that never, never, never usurps the plain sense meaning and is frankly an abuse of the text and an error. So ye be warned. Now, think about it like this. Peshat, right? That's the first layer of meaning. The plain sense, straightforward reading of a text is the meaning of the text. Everything else is frosting. So that frosting might be sweet and it might taste good. It might be valuable, but it's still just frosting. So quick example, a sermon comparing passages that we can get out of them for our own personal lives. That might be a Darosh layer, a D layer in our word paradise, comparative. But it doesn't mean that the passage itself was about that specific outcome for today. And I want to encourage you to avoid making the text about you. It's not about you. And people, especially in the West, in America, they have a tendency to be individualistic and self-centered and selfish. Also, we do amazing things, so it's not being super pessimistic about the West and about America. But, you know, it really is not about you individually. It's not a love letter written to you personally. That is a fallacy of interpretation, and I find that often in evangelical thinking, that the text isn't just a text, it's a love letter written to them personally, because they treat God in a very informal way. And if you've ever been to a church that is more of the evangelical stripe, they do range, but if any of those ones where it's more, it comes you are, flip-flops, shorts, you know, t-shirt with barbecue stains on it, they just want you to come. They just want you to come, and they want to remove barriers. They want to make God more informal and more friendly. And there's problems with that because they want to flatten out the curve, so to speak. They want to make it more egalitarian. That can lead to a familiarity. Now, familiarity, of course, breeds contempt. And we're talking about God's nature. God's distinct nature isn't actually love. God's distinct nature is holiness. And that holiness means he's something else. He's something other. Now, he's something other. And because he's something other, he manifests that great love. And you could say in some sense that love and holiness are not actually mutually exclusive, but that's for another episode. So try to avoid that sowed layer. It's not really something to play with. It can be selfish and self-centered when applied across the board. And there are, of course, personal moments, for sure. Those, however, do not usurp the plain sense meaning of the passage and are more closely aligned with that mystical sodic level. Let me give you a few other examples. So let me give you a few other examples. The medieval Quadriga. Christians and Muslims have, of course, robust hermeneutical systems too. And Christians had four methods of interpreting. Literally, which is basically the same thing as the Peshat approach. They had a moral viewing, though it could be more likely to be understood. We might call that more of a psychological reading. They had allegory. They loved allegory. Medieval Christians did. Viewing passages as a type of something else. So the Song of Solomon, for example, was seen as an allegory between God and Christ. Though the Jewish tradition, too, engaged in an allegorical reading, mostly because they were uncomfortable with the Song of Solomon and the real sexuality that's expressed in the Song of Solomon, which we should take with a grain of salt because it was a song. That's why in the Catholic tradition it's called Canticles. It was a song about one of Solomon's 1,000 wives that he actually maybe, probably, liked, sort of. It's hard to say. So Christians aren't the only ones who do allegory. That's my point here. We can look at Matthew's attempt to make Jesus the new Moses. You can look at some of those problems that are inherent in doing that, because it ignores the plain sense reading and really only works on a shallow level. That's what allegory does. It's not meant to work in a robust manner. It might make a parallel between one smaller portion and another. Let's look at a mystical meaning that might be used. And let's take the example of the nation of Israel in the book of Joshua being outside of the land of Canaan, the promised land, and they're confronting the Jordan River. The Jordan River is the boundary. It's the barrier into the land of promise. So a mystical meaning might be something like, Canaan is the land of promise, and to cross over, we must cross the Jordan, and the Jordan River becomes the river of death into Canaan. And Canaan, in this mystical or metaphysical reading, is heaven itself. And maybe you can use that devotionally and feel like you are confirmed in your faith and your experience, and you're calm in the face of death because the promised land awaits. Now imagine if you were at the bedside of someone who's dying, and you're speaking to them, and you're sharing this passage, and you're ministering to that person, and you're reading from that section of the Torah, and you came to that portion, and you told them you're just outside the promised land. It's just crossing the Jordan River. That's all. And once you cross over, you're going to be in the promised land. Heaven awaits. And that might bring comfort to someone who's dying. And you hold their hand, you tell them it's going to be okay, because soon you're going to be in Canaan, a land full of milk and honey. That would be a use of that passage. It's not the plain sense reading. It's not what the text means. But that might be a way that you can expand the text to more of a mystical or metaphysical kind of meaning to really help somebody else as they're facing death, because that's exactly what you would want someone to do for you. But I want to be clear, and you should be clear about this too. So Peshat is the meaning. Straight is the way. Don't let anyone tell you differently. Don't let the priests and the pastors and the so-called prophets tell you anything else. Don't let them twist it and turn it and weaponize it against you. All right, that's our episode. And I am your subversive scribe, Hesh, and stay subversive, and we'll catch you in the next episode. Thanks for listening. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Support for the Subversive Scribe comes from private subscribers, generous supporters, and a community of inquiring people who are willing to take the biblical texts seriously and subversively. Join the Scriven Insurgents, the private community built for Subversive Scribe podcast subscribers, on our Locals page at subversivescribe.locals.com. Click on Become a Supporter, and for $5 a month as a member of the Scriven Insurgents, you get access to private Subversive Scribe episodes, teaching series, audible commentaries, and exclusive content. Your support makes the Subversive Scribe podcast possible. Join the Scriven Insurgents and stay subversive.